Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record Program Number 586, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This is being recorded on February 19th of the year 2007. Well, happy President's Day. Those of you who are out in the listening audience, today is Monday, February 19th. Today is President's Day, the day on which we observe the birthdays of George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. Both of them actually, not only two of the better presidents in American history, but both of them actually Republicans, which just goes to show you how far things have disintegrated since the time of George and Abe. I guess looking at the way things have gone, one could say that the party of George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, and Norman Rockwell has become the party of George Lincoln Rockwell. George Lincoln Rockwell, by the way, the Führer of the American Nazi Party, and an individual whose Arlington, Virginia name, address, and telephone number were in Lee Harvey Oswald's address book at the time, whose name, I should say, Arlington, Virginia address and phone number, were in Oswald's address book at the time of his arrest. That's Oswald, the supposed lone nut communist who supposedly killed President Kennedy. Yep, things have slid quite a ways down as we look back and perhaps forward on President's Day. Let me, before we begin updating miscellaneous articles and various stories that I've covered over the years, let me encourage listeners emphatically to use the programs that they use the material that's available on the website. For a long time, I've been accumulating a tremendous amount of information on the Internet. I turn each program into a long article-length description. Often, the descriptions have material that was not included into the original broadcast due to limitations of time. For example, with regard to For the Record Program 585, there was a piece of the essay that occupied the second half of the broadcast that I simply did not have time to read due to the limitations of time, obviously. The entire essay will be available, actually it's already available on the internet, on the Spitfire website. The entire essay will be available in print so people can examine it at length, in detail, and in particular can peruse the material that was not included in the original broadcast. So please, www.spitfirelist.com and the linked websites, a cornucopia of invaluable information. One of the stories that I've been covering for a long time on this broadcast, something that was actually one of the focal points of the very first archive show, Uncle Sam and the Swastika, from May 23rd of 1980, and that is the subject not only of the collaboration between major American corporations and Nazi Germany, but in particular the collaboration between General Motors and other automotive companies in this country and Nazi Germany. The petroleum industry as well, which along with the automobile industry constitutes something of a giant mega industry, was inextricably linked with the Third Reich. And we're going to continue with that particular subject. This is not a subject that we are with which the listeners are unfamiliar. However, the fact that this subject occupied not only a prominent place on the front page of the Insight section of the San Francisco Sunday Chronicle on January 7th of this year, but also the fact that it occupied the entire back page of the opinion section of the Sunday Chronicle is worth noting, because even though the profound connections between corporate America and not only Nazi Germany, but the other fascist powers of World War II have been known for some time, it is comparatively rare that this subject makes it into the daily press. However, again, on Sunday, January 7th of 2007, the San Francisco Chronicle included the following article placed prominently on the front page of its Insight section, its editorial section, in the newspaper, and then continued on the back. This article is by Edwin Black, the author of, among other books, The War Against the Weak and IBM and the Holocaust. And Edwin Black has done quite a bit of writing about the American industrial connection to Nazi Germany. And he titled this article about General Motors and its relationship to Nazi Germany, Nazis' Road to War on GM Wheels. It's by Edwin Black, of course, and I'm going to read it in its entirety into the record. James D. Mooney thrust his arm diagonally, watching its reflection in his hotel suite mirror. Not quite right, he tried once again, still not right. Was it too stiff? too slanted? Should his palm stretch perpendicular to the ceiling? Should his arm bend at a severe angle? Or should the entire limb extend straight from shoulder to fingertips? Should his sigheil project enthusiasm or declare obedience? Never mind, it was afternoon time. Time to go see Hitler. Just the day before, May 1, 1934, under a brilliant, cloudless sky, Mooney, president of the General Motors Overseas Corporation, climbed into his automobile and drove toward Tempelhof Field at the outskirts of Berlin to attend yet another hypnotic Nazi extravaganza. This one was the annual May Day Festival. Tempelhof Field was a sprawling, oblong-shaped airfield, but for May Day, the immense site was converted into a parade ground. Security was more than tense, it was paranoid. All cars entering the area were meticulously inspected for anti-Hitler pamphlets or other contraband, but not Mooney's. The Führer's office had sent over a special windshield tag that granted the General Motors chief carte blanche to any area of Tempelhof. Mooney would be Hitler's special guest. As Mooney arrived at the airfield about 3:30 in the afternoon, the spectacle dazzled him. Sweeping swastika banners stretching 33 feet wide and soaring 150 feet into the air fluttered from 43-ton steel towers. Each tower was anchored in 13 feet of concrete to resist the winds as steadfastly as the Third Reich resisted all efforts to moderate its program of rearmament and oppression. Thousands of other Nazi flags fluttered across the grounds as dense column after column of Nazis marching shoulder to shoulder in syncopation flowed into the rigid formation. Each of the 13 parade columns boasted 30 to 90,000 stormtroopers, army divisions, citizen brigades, and blonde, blue Hitler youth enrollees. Finally, after 4 hours, the tightly packed assemblage totaled about 2 million marchers and attendees. Hitler eventually arrived in an open-air automobile that cruised up and down the field amid the sea of devotees. Accompanied by cadres of SS guards, Hitler was ushered to the stage, stopping first to pat the head of a smiling boy. This would be yet another grandiose spectacle of Führer worship so emblematic to the Nazi regime. When ready, Hitler launched into one of his enthralling speeches, made all the more mesmerizing by 142 loudspeakers sprinkled throughout the grounds. As the Führer demanded hard work and discipline and enunciated his vision of National Socialist destiny, the crisp sound of his voice traveled across an audience so vast that it took a moment or two for his words to reach the perimeter of the throng. Hence, the thunderous applause that greeted Hitler's remarks arrived sequentially, creating an aural effect of continuous overlapping waves of adulation. General Motors World, the company house organ, covered the May Day event glowingly in a several-page cover story stressing Hitler's boundless affinity for children. Quote, "By 9, the streets were full of people waiting to see Herr Hitler go meet the children," unquote, the publication reported. The next day, May 2, 1934, after practicing his Sieg Heil in front of a mirror, Mooney and two other senior executives from General Motors and its German division, Adam Opel AG, went to meet Hitler in his chancellery office. Waiting with Hitler would be Nazi Party stalwart Joachim von Ribbentrop, who would later become foreign minister, and Reich economic advisor Wilhelm Kepler. As Mooney traversed the long approach to Hitler's desk, he began to pump his arm in a stern-faced Sieg Heil, but the Führer surprised him by getting up from his desk and meeting Mooney halfway, not with a salute, but a business-like handshake. This was, after all, a meeting about business. One of many contacts between the Nazis and GM officials that are spotlighted in thousands of pages of little-known and restricted Nazi-era and New Deal-era documents. This documentation and other evidence reveals that GM and Opel were eager, willing, and indispensable cogs in the Third Reich's rearmament juggernaut, a rearmament that, as many feared during the 1930s, would enable Hitler to conquer Europe and destroy millions of lives. Hitler knew that the biggest auto and truck manufacturer in Germany was not Daimler or any other German car maker. The biggest automotive manufacturer in Germany, indeed in all of Europe, was General Motors, which since 1929 had owned and operated the longtime German company Opel. GM's Opel, infused with millions in GM cash and assembly line know-how, produced about 40% of the vehicles in Germany and about 65% of its exports. Indeed, Opel dominated Germany's auto industry. As the May 2, 1934 Chancellery meeting progressed, Hitler thanked Muni and GM for being a major employer, about 17,000 jobs, in a Germany where Nazi success hinged on re-employment. Moreover, because Opel was responsible for about 65% of auto exports, the company also brought in the foreign currency desperately needed by the Reich to purchase raw materials for its re-employment, as well as for the regime's crash rearmament program. Now, as Hitler embarked on a huge threatening rearmament program, GM was in a position to make Germany's military a powerful, modern, and motorized marvel. A few weeks after the prolonged chancellery session, the company publication, General Motors World, effusively recounted the meeting, proclaiming, quote, "Hitler is a strong man, well fitted to lead the German people out of their former economic distress. He is leading them not by force or fear, but by intelligent planning and execution of fundamentally sound principles of government," unquote. For Muni, and for Germany's branch of General Motors, the relationship with the Third Reich was first and foremost about making money, billions in 21st century dollars, off the Nazi desire to rearm, even though the world expected that Germany would plunge Europe and America into a devastating war. Today, General Motors is reluctant to talk about its links with the Nazis, but a spokesman said, quote, "General Motors finds the atrocities committed by the Nazi regime abhorrent and among the darkest days of our collective history. General Motors deeply regrets any role the company or its vehicles played in the Nazi era," unquote. By the spring of 1933, the world was beginning to learn about the lawlessness and savagery of the Nazi regime and the Reich's determination to crush its Jewish community and threaten its neighbors. Beginning in the late spring of 1933, concentration camps such as Dachau were generating headlines reporting great brutality. By June of 1933, Jews everywhere in Germany were being banned from the professional, economic, and cultural life of the country. As state-designated pariahs, they were forbidden to remain members of the German Automobile Association, the popular organization for the general German motorist. Hitler's anti-Semitic demagoguery and the daily, semi-official, violent attacks against Jews were discussed in the American media almost daily. GM's president, Alfred P. Sloan, knew what was happening in Germany. Sloan and General Motors officials also knew that Hitler's regime was expected to wage war from the outset. Headlines, radio broadcasts, and newsreels made that fact apparent. America, it was feared, would once again be pulled in. Nonetheless, GM and Germany began a strategic business relationship. Opel became an essential element of the German rearmament and modernization Hitler required to subjugate Europe. To accomplish that, Germany needed to rise above the horse-drawn divisions it deployed in World War I. It needed to motorize, to blitz, that is, to attack with lightning speed. Germany would later unleash a blitzkrieg, a lightning war. Opel built a 3-ton truck named Blitz to support the German military. The Blitz truck and its numerous specialized models became the mainstay of the Blitzkrieg. This last passage again, and by the way, do note that as we cited in our Miscellaneous Archive Show M11, or as in For the Record Program Number 511, the General Motors subsidiary, Adam Opel AG, was Hitler's largest tank producer in World War II. Number two was Ford of Cologne, a wholly owned subsidiary of the Ford Motor Company. Repeating this last sentence, Opel built the 3-ton truck named Blitz to support the German military. The Blitz truck and its numerous specialized models became the mainstay of the Blitzkrieg. In 1935, GM agreed to locate a new factory at Brandenburg, where it would be geographically less vulnerable to feared aerial bombardment by Allied forces. In 1937, almost 17% of Opel's Blitz trucks were sold directly to the Nazi military. That military sales figure was increased to 29% in 1938, totaling about 6,000 Blitz trucks that year alone. The Wehrmacht, the German military, soon became Opel's number one customer by far. Other important customers included major industries associated with the Hitler war machine. Expanding its German workforce from 17,000 in 1934 to 27,000 in 1938 also made GM one of Germany's leading employers. Unquestionably, GM's Opel became an integral facet of Hitler's Reich. More than just an efficient manufacturer, Opel openly embraced the bizarre philosophy that powered the Nazi military-industrial complex. The German company participated in cultic Führer worship as part of its daily corporate ethic. After all, until GM purchased Opel in 1929 for $33.3 million, or about one-third of GM's after-tax profits that year, Opel was an established carmaker with a respected German persona. The Opel family included several prominent Nazi Party members. This identity appealed to rank-and-file Nazis who condemned anything foreign-owned or foreign-made. For all these reasons, during the Hitler years, Sloan and Mooney both made efforts to obscure Opel's American ownership and control. Of course, GM's subsidiary vigorously joined the anti-Jewish movement required of leading businesses serving the Reich. Jewish employees and suppliers became verboten. To conceal American ownership and reinforce the masquerade that Opel stood as a purely Aryan enterprise, Sloan and Mooney of General Motors, beginning in 1934, conducted the concept of a directorate comprised of prominent German personalities, including several with Nazi Party membership. This created what GM officials variously termed a camouflage or a false facade, unquote, of local management. But the decisions were made in America. GM, as the sole stockholder, controlled Opel's board and the corporate votes. Among the decisions made in America, beginning in about 1935, was the one transferring to Germany the technology to produce the modern gasoline additive tetraethyl lead, commonly called ethyl or leaded gasoline. This allowed the Reich to boost octane that provided better automotive performance by eliminating disruptive engine pings and jolts. Better performance meant a faster and more mobile fighting force, just what the Reich would ultimately need for its swift and mobile blitzkrieg. Years after the war, Nazi armaments chief Albert Speer told a congressional investigator that Germany could not have attempted its September 1939 blitzkrieg of Poland without the performance-boosting additive. Within a few years of partnering with the Hitler regime, Opel began to dwarf all competition. By 1937, GM subsidiary had grown to triple the size of Daimler-Benz. In 1938, just months after the Nazis' annexation of Austria, Mooney, head of GM's overseas operations, received the German Eagle with Cross, the highest medal Hitler awarded to foreign commercial collaborators and supporters. On November 9th and 10th, 1938, shortly after Mooney's decoration, nationwide pogroms broke out in Germany against the Jews, Die Kristallnacht. The American public was finally shocked onto its heels by the night of officially orchestrated burning, looting, and mob action against Jews. By the summer of 1940, a senior GM executive wrote this assessment for internal circulation only. He explained that while the management of Adam Opel AG is in the hands of German nationals, unquote, in point of fact, GM is still, again quoting, actively represented by two American executives on the board of directors, unquote. The German-American balance of the many management entities created in the facade of control was constantly shifting during the Hitler years. But regardless of the number of members, German or American, on the various directing, managing, or executive boards and committees, GM in the United States controlled all voting stock and could veto or permit all operations. For all intents and purposes, though, once war began, Wehrmacht requirements and orders determined the specifics of military manufacturing at Opel. Like any nation at war, including the United States itself, the Reich alone determined what weapons would be made by its militarized factories. That said, it was GM's decision to remain operating in Germany, to continue to subject itself to Reich military orders, and answer the Reich's call for even more lethal weapons. As anticipated, Opel's Brandenburg facilities were conscripted and converted to an airplane engine plant supplying the Luftwaffe's Ju-88 bombers. Later, Opel's plants also built landmines and torpedo detonators. The factories and infrastructure that GM built during the 1930s were, in fact, finally used for their intended purpose, war. Opel built trucks on the ground, Opel-powered bombers in the sky, and Opel-detonated torpedoes in the seas brought terror to Europe. A few weeks later, in May of 1941, a year and a half after World War II broke out, with newspapers and newsreels constantly transmitting the grim news that millions had been displaced, murdered, or enslaved by Nazi aggression, and that London was decimated by the Blitz bombing campaign, Sloan, then in his mid-60s, told his closest executives during a Detroit briefing, quote, "I am sure we all realize that this struggle that is going on throughout the world is really nothing more or less than a conflict between two opposing technocracies manifesting itself to the capitalization of economic resources and products and all that sort of thing," unquote. By now, Assistant Secretary of State Adolph Burley, whose portfolio included the investigation of Nazi fronts and sympathizers in Latin America, had had enough of Sloan and General Motors executives. Burley circulated a memo asserting, quote, that certain officials of General Motors were sympathetic to or aligned with some pro-Axis groups, and that this is a real, quote, fifth column, unquote, and is much more sinister than many other things which are going on at the present time, unquote. Burley called for an FBI investigation. The FBI's probe of GM senior executives with links to Hitler found collusion with Germany by Mooney, but no evidence of any disloyalty to America. The August 2, 1941 summary of the investigation clearly lists Sloan in the title of the report, but Mooney's was the only name mentioned in the investigative results. In a separate report to FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, the agent stated, quote, "No derogatory information of any kind was developed with respect to Alfred Pritchard Sloan, Jr.," unquote. On December 7, 1941, Pearl Harbor was bombed. The United States declared war on Japan. On December 11th, German diplomats in Washington called on the State Department to deliver Germany's declaration of war against America. All direct communications between GM and its Opel subsidiary in Germany were necessarily severed, although historians have always wondered about indirect links through Denmark, where GM operated a long-time subsidiary. Ranking GM men from Denmark were also in ranking positions both in Opel in Germany and GM in America. After Germany declared war on America, all American corporate interests in Germany or under German control were systematically placed under the jurisdiction of a Reich-appointed custodian for enemy-owned property. In practice, the custodian was akin to a court-appointed receiver. Generally, the Reich custodian's duty was not to dismember the firm or Aryanize it, but to continue to run the enterprise as efficiently and profitably as possible, holding all assets and profits in escrow until matters would be resolved after the war. In the case of Opel, Carl Luer, L-U-E-R, the longtime member of the Opel Supervisory Board, company president, and Nazi Party stalwart, was appointed by the Reich to run Opel as custodian, but only some 11 months after America entered the war. In anticipation of the outbreak of hostilities, GM had appointed Luer to be president of Opel in late 1941, just before war broke out. So the existing GM-approved president of Opel continued to run Opel during America's war years. The company continued as a major German war profiteer, and GM knew its subsidiary was at the forefront of the Nazi war machine. In the wartime months and years that ensued, 1941 to 45, GM built and operated some $900 million, about $120 billion in today's dollars, of defense manufacturing facilities for the Allies. Secretary of War Henry Stimson later explained that when a capitalist country wages war, quote, "you have got to let business make money out of the process or business won't work," unquote. GM also reaped the financial benefits of its relationship with the Third Reich. During the pre-war Hitler years, GM entered its Opel proceeds under reserves, unquote, instead of listing the profits as ordinary income. Then, during America's war years, GM declared it had abandoned its Nazi subsidiary and took a complete tax write-off under special legislation signed by Roosevelt in October of 1942. The write-off of nearly $35 million created a tax deduction of approximately $22.7 million or about $285 billion in 21st century money, according to an internal Opel document. But Opel's friendly Nazi custodian Luhr kept on making profits for the company during those war years. Opel produced trucks, bomber engines, landmines, torpedo detonators, and other war materiel, a significant amount of it by the sweat of thousands of prisoner laborers or other coerced workers. Some of those workers were tortured if they did not meet expectations. Those profits and GM's 100% stock ownership were preserved by the Reich custodian, even though GM and Opel ostensibly severed ties with each other after America entered the war. During the Hitler years, many of these excess profits were used to acquire other companies and properties, only increasing Opel's assets in Germany. After the war, starting in 1948, GM began regaining control over Opel operations and eventually its monumental assets as well as block dividends. GM also collected some $33 million in war reparations, unquote, because the Allies had bombed its German facilities. In 1953, when GM President Charlie Wilson was nominated to be Secretary of Defense, he was asked at his confirmation hearing if he could make a decision in the country's interest that was contrary to GM's interest. Wilson shot back with his famous comment, quote, "I cannot conceive of one, because for years I thought that what was good for our country was good for General Motors, and vice versa. The difference did not exist. Our company was too big," unquote. Indeed, what GM had accomplished in both America and Nazi Germany could not have been bigger, unquote. Well, that story, again, from the Sunday San Francisco Chronicle's Insight or Opinion section. It occupies much of the front page, all of the back page. It's by Edwin Black, the author of The War Against the Weak and IBM and the Holocaust, among other titles. Nothing particularly revelatory there for the veteran listener to this broadcast, but it is very, very unusual indeed to see an article touching on the U.S. Nazi industrial collaboration occupying such a prominent place in a major American daily newspaper. Plenty of information about that in other broadcasts. I would also note in passing that the same elements, many of the same ones, including people around the Morgan Industrial Group, people associated with the DuPont Group and General Motors, closely associated in those years with DuPont, that many of those same industrialists and financiers attempted to overthrow Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the 1934 coup attempt that is discussed in For the Record Program number 48 and also in For the Record Program number 475 as well. These citations and others will be included in the description for the record program number 586. We're going to be continuing with other miscellaneous articles and updates of other stories on Side 2. Again, please utilize the Spitfire website and the many linked websites, a tremendous body of information, including at this point a small mini library of old anti-fascist books that, among other things, will cover the subject of the American corporate connections to fascist Italy, Nazi Germany, and Imperial Japan at great length and in detail. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record Program number 586, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This has been recorded on February 19th of the year 2007. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.